Tavia comes up and pats Venia's back soothingly, her curvy body looking plumper than usual next to Venia's thin, angular one.
There, there, you can fix those in no time.
But what am I going to do with these nails? She grabs my hand and pins it flat between her two pea-green ones. No, her skin isn't exactly pea-green now. It's more of a light evergreen. The shift in shade is no doubt an attempt to stay abreast of the capricious fashion trends of the capital.
Really, Katniss, you could have left me something to work with, she wails.
It's true. I've bitten my nails to stubs in the past couple of months. I thought about trying to break the habit, but couldn't think of a good reason I should. Sorry, I mutter. I hadn't really been spending much time worrying about how it might affect my prep team. Flavius lifts a few strands of my wet, tangled hair. He gives his head a disapproving shake, causing his orange corkscrew curls to bounce around.
Has anyone touched this since you last saw us? He asks sternly. Remember, we specifically asked you to leave your hair alone.
Yes, I say, grateful that I can show I haven't totally taken them for granted. I mean, no, no one's cut it. I did remember that.
No, I didn't. It's more like the issue never came up.
Since I've been home, all I've done is stick it in its usual old braid down my back. This seems to mollify them, and they all kiss me, set me on a chair in my bedroom, and as usual, start talking non-stop without bothering to notice if I'm listening. While Venia reinvents my eyebrows, and Octavia gives me fake nails, and Flavius massages goo into my hair, I hear all about the capital. What a hit the games were, how dull things have been since, how no one can wait until Peter and I visit again at the end of the victory tour. After that, it won't be long before the capital begins gearing up for the quarter quell.
Isn't it thrilling?
Don't you feel so lucky?
In your very first year of being a victor, you get to be a mentor in a quarter quell.
Their words overlap in a blur of excitement. Oh, yes, I say neutrally. It's the best I can do. In a normal year, being a mentor to the tributes is the stuff of nightmares. I can't walk by the school now without wondering what kid I'll have to coach. But to make things even worse, this is the year of the 75th Hunger Games, and that means it's also a quarter quell. They occur every 25 years, marking the anniversary of the district's defeat, with over-the-top celebrations and, for extra fun, some miserable twist for the tributes. I've never been alive for one, of course, but in school I remember hearing that for the second quarter quell, the capital demanded that twice the number of tributes be provided for the arena. The teachers didn't go into much more detail, which is surprising, because that was the year District 12's very own Haymitch Abernathy won the crown.
Haymitch better be preparing himself for a lot of attention, squeals Octavia.
Haymitch has never mentioned his personal experience in the arena to me. I would never ask. And if I ever saw his games televised in reruns, I must have been too young to remember it. But the capital won't let him forget it this year. In a way, it's a good thing Peter and I will both be available as mentors during the quell, because it's a sure bet that Haymitch will be wasted. After they've exhausted the topic of the quarter quell, my prep team launches into a whole lot of stuff about their incomprehensibly silly lives. Who said what about someone I've never heard of, and what sort of shoes they just bought, and a long story from Octavia about what a mistake it was to have everyone wear feathers to her birthday party. Soon my brows are stinging, my hair's smooth and silky, and my nails are ready to be painted. Apparently, they've been given instruction to prepare only my hands and face, probably because everything else will be covered in the cold weather. Flavius badly wants to use his own trademark purple lipstick on me, but resigns himself to a pink as they begin to color my face and nails. I can see by the palette Cinna has assigned that we're going for girlish, not sexy.
Good.
I'll never convince anyone of anything if I'm trying to be provocative. Hamish made that very clear when he was coaching me for my interview for the games. My mother comes in, somewhat shyly, and says that Cinna has asked her to show the preps how she did my hair the day of the reaping. They respond with enthusiasm and then watch, thoroughly engrossed, as she breaks down the process of the elaborate braided hairdo. In the mirror, I can see their earnest faces following her every move, their eagerness when it is their turn to try a step. In fact, all three are so readily respectful and nice to my mother that I feel bad about how I go around feeling so superior to them. Who knows who I would be or what I would talk about if I'd been raised in the capital? Maybe my biggest regret would be having feathered costumes at my birthday party, too. When my hair is done, I find Cinna downstairs in the living room, and just the sight of him makes me feel more hopeful. He looks the same as always, simple clothes, short brown hair, just a hint of gold eyeliner. We embrace, and I can barely keep from spilling out the entire episode with President Snow. But no, I've decided to tell Hamish first. He'll know best who to burden with it. It's so easy to talk to Cinna, though. Lately we've been speaking a lot on the telephone that came with the house. It's sort of a joke, because almost no one else we know owns one. There's Peter, but obviously I don't call him. Hamish tore his out of the wall years ago. My friend Madge, the mayor's daughter, has a telephone in her house, but if we want to talk, we do it in person. At first, the thing barely ever got used. Then Cinna started to call to work on my talent. Every victor is supposed to have one. Your talent is the activity you take up since you don't have to work either in school or your district's industry. It can be anything, really. Anything that they can interview you about. Peta, it turns out, actually has a talent, which is painting. He's been frosting those cakes and cookies for years in his family's bakery. But now that he's rich, he can afford to smear real paint on canvases. I don't have a talent, unless you count hunting illegally, which they don't. Or maybe singing, which I wouldn't do for the capital in a million years. My mother tried to interest me in a variety of suitable alternatives from a list Effie Trinket sent her. Cooking, flower arranging, playing the flute. None of them took, although Prim had a knack for all three. Finally, Cinna stepped in and offered to help me develop my passion for designing clothes, which really required development since it was non-existent. But I said yes because it meant getting to talk to Cinna, and he promised he'd do all the work. Now he's arranging things around my living room, clothing, fabrics, and sketchbooks with designs he's drawn. I pick up one of the sketchbooks and examine a dress I supposedly created. "You know, I think I show a lot of promise," I say. "Get dressed, you worthless thing," he says, tossing a bundle of clothes at me. I may have no interest in designing clothes, but I do love the ones Cinna makes for me. Like these, flowing black pants made of a thick, warm material. A comfortable white shirt. A sweater woven from green and blue and gray strands of kitten-soft wool. Laced leather boots that don't pinch my toes. "Did I design my outfit?" I ask. "No, you aspire to design your outfit and be like me, your fashion hero," says Cinna. He hands me a small stack of cards. "You'll read these off-camera while they're filming the clothes. Try to sound like you care." Just then, Effie Trinket arrives in a pumpkin-orange wig to remind everyone, "We're on a schedule!" She kisses me on both cheeks while waving in the camera crew, then orders me into position. Effie's the only reason we got anywhere on time in the capital, so I try to accommodate her. I start bobbing around like a puppet, holding up outfits and saying meaningless things like, "Don't you love it?" The sound team records me reading from my cards in a chirpy voice so they can insert it later. Then I'm tossed out of the room so they can film my, Cinna's, designs in peace. Prim got out early from school for the event. Now she stands in the kitchen, being interviewed by another crew. She looks lovely in a sky-blue frock that brings out her eyes, her blonde hair pulled back in a matching ribbon. She's leaning a bit forward on the toes of her shiny white boots, like she's about to take flight. Like, bam! It's like someone actually hits me in the chest. No one has, of course, but the pain is so real, I take a step back. I squeeze my eyes shut, and I don't see Prim. I see Rue, the 12-year-old girl from District 11, who was my ally in the arena. She could fly, bird-like, from tree to tree, catching on to the slenderest branches. Rue, who I didn't save, who I let die. I picture her lying on the ground with the spear still wedged in her stomach. Who else will I fail to save from the capital's vengeance? Who else will be dead if I don't satisfy President Snow? I realize Cinna's trying to put a coat on me, so I raise my arms. I feel fur inside and out encasing me. It's from no animal I've ever seen. Ermine, he tells me as I stroke the white sleeve. Leather gloves. A bright red scarf. Something furry covers my ears. You're bringing earmuffs back in style. I hate earmuffs, I think. They make it hard to hear, and since I was blasted deaf in one ear in the arena, I dislike them even more. After I won, the Capitol repaired my ear, but I still find myself testing it. My mother hurries up with something cupped in her hand. For good luck, she says. It's the pin Madge gave me before I left for the games. A mockingjay flying in a circle of gold. I tried to give it to Rue, but she wouldn't take it. She said the pin was the reason she'd decided to trust me. Cinna fixes it on the knot in the scarf. Effie Trinket's nearby, clapping her hands. Attention, everyone! We're about to do the first outdoor shot, where the victors greet each other at the beginning of their marvelous trip. All right, Katniss, big smile. You're very excited, right? I don't exaggerate when I say she shoves me out the door. For a moment I can't quite see right because of the snow, which is now coming down in earnest. Then I make out Peter coming through his front door. In my head I hear President Snow's directive, "Convince me." And I know I must. My face breaks into a huge smile, and I start walking in Peter's direction. Then, as if I can't stand it another second, I start running. He catches me and spins me around, and then he slips. He still isn't entirely in command of his artificial leg, and we fall into the snow, me on top of him. And that's where we have our first kiss in months. It's full of fur and snowflakes and lipstick. But underneath all that, I can feel the steadiness that Peter brings to everything, and I know I'm not alone. As badly as I have hurt him, he won't expose me in front of the cameras, won't condemn me with a half-hearted kiss. He's still looking out for me, just as he did in the arena. Somehow the thought makes me want to cry. Instead, I pull him to his feet, tuck my glove through the crook of his arm, and merrily pull him on our way. The rest of the day is a blur of getting to the station, bidding everyone goodbye, the train pulling out, the old team, Peter and me, Effie and Hamish, Cinna and Portia, Peter's stylist, dining on an indescribably delicious meal I don't remember. And then I'm swathed in pajamas and a voluminous robe, sitting in my plush compartment, waiting for the others to go to sleep. I know Hamish will be up for hours. He doesn't like to sleep when it's dark out. When the train seems quiet, I put on my slippers and pad down to his door. I have to knock several times before he answers, scowling, as if he's certain I've brought bad news.
"What do you want?"
he says, nearly knocking me out with a cloud of wine fumes.
"I have to talk to you,"
I whisper.
"Now?" he says.
I nod.
"This better be good."
He waits, but I feel certain every word we utter on a capital train is being recorded.
"Well?"
he barks. The train starts to brake, and for a second, I think President Snow is watching me and doesn't approve of my confiding in Haymitch and has decided to go ahead and kill me now. But we're just stopping for fuel.
"The train's so stuffy," I say.
It's a harmless phrase, but I see Haymitch's eyes narrow in understanding.
"I know what you need."
He pushes past me and lurches down the hall to a door. When he wrestles it open, a blast of snow hits us. He trips out onto the ground. A capital attendant rushes to help, but Haymitch waves her away good-naturedly as he staggers off.
"Just want some fresh air. Only be a minute."
"Sorry, he's drunk," I say apologetically. "I'll get him." I hop down and stumble along the track behind him, soaking my slippers with snow, as he leads me beyond the end of the train so we will not be overheard. Then he turns on me.
"What?"
I tell him everything. About the president's visit, about Gale, about how we're all going to die if I fail. His face sobers, grows older in the glow of the red taillights.
"Then you can't fail."
"If you could just help me get through this trip," I begin.
"No, Katniss, it's not just this trip,"
he says. "What do you mean?" I say.
"Even if you pull it off, they'll be back in another few months to take us all to the games. You and PETA, you'll be mentors now. Every year from here on out, and every year they'll revisit the romance and broadcast the details of your private life, and you'll never, ever be able to do anything but live happily ever after with that boy."
The full impact of what he's saying hits me. I will never have a life with Gale, even if I want to. I will never be allowed to live alone. I will have to be forever in love with PETA. The capital will insist on it. I'll have a few years, maybe, because I'm still only 16, to stay with my mother in Prim. And then...
"Do you understand what I mean?"
He presses me. I nod. He means there's only one future if I want to keep those I love alive and stay alive myself. I'll have to marry PETA. Chapter 4. We slog back to the train in silence. In the hallway outside my door, Haymitch gives my shoulder a pat and says,
"You could do a lot worse, you know."
He heads off to his compartment, taking the smell of wine with him. In my room, I remove my sodden slippers, my wet robe, and pajamas. There are more in the drawers, but I just crawl between the covers of my bed in my underclothes. I stare into the darkness, thinking about my conversation with Haymitch. Everything he said was true about the capital's expectations, my future with PETA, even his last comment. Of course, I could do a lot worse than PETA. That isn't really the point, though, is it? One of the few freedoms we have in District 12 is the right to marry who we want or not marry at all. And now even that has been taken away from me. I wonder if President Snow will insist we have children. If we do, they'll have to face the reaping each year. And wouldn't it be something to see the child of not one, but two victors chosen for the arena? Victor's children have been in the ring before. It always causes a lot of excitement and generates talk about how the odds are not in that family's favor. But it happens too frequently to just be about odds. Gale's convinced the capital does it on purpose, rigs the drawings to add extra drama. Given all the trouble I've caused, I've probably guaranteed any child of mine a spot in the games. I think of Haymitch, unmarried, no family, blotting out the world with drink. He could have had his choice of any woman in the district. and he chose solitude. Not solitude. That sounds too peaceful. More like solitary confinement. Was it because, having been in the arena, he knew it was better than risking the alternative? I had a taste of that alternative when they called Prim's name on Reaping Day, and I watched her walk to the stage to her death. But as her sister, I could take her place, an option forbidden to our mother. My mind searches frantically for a way out. I can't let President Snow condemn me to this, even if it means taking my own life. Before that, though, I'd try to run away. What would they do if I simply vanished? Disappeared into the woods and never came out? Could I even manage to take everyone I love with me? Start a new life deep in the wild? Highly unlikely, but not impossible. I shake my head to clear it. This is not the time to be making wild escape plans. I must focus on the victory tour. Too many people's fates depend on my giving a good show. Dawn comes before sleep does, and there's Effie rapping on my door. I pull on whatever clothes are at the top of the drawer and drag myself down to the dining car. I don't see what difference it makes when I get up, since this is a travel day, but then it turns out that yesterday's makeover was just to get me to the train station. Today I'll get the works from my prep team. Why, it's too cold for anything to show, I grumble. Not in District 11, says Effie. District 11, our first stop. I'd rather start in any other district, since this was Rue's home. But that's not how the victory tour works. Usually it kicks off in 12 and then goes in descending district order to 1, followed by the capital. The victor's district is skipped and saved for very last. Since 12 puts on the least fabulous celebration, usually just a dinner for the tributes and a victory rally in the square, where nobody looks like they're having any fun, it's probably best to get us out of the way as soon as possible. This year, for the first time since Haymitch won, the final stop on the tour will be 12, and the capital will spring for the festivities. I try to enjoy the food like Hazel said. The kitchen staff clearly wants to please me. They've prepared my favorite lamb stew with dried plums, among other delicacies. Orange juice and a pot of steaming hot chocolate wait at my place at the table. So I eat a lot, and the meal is beyond reproach. But I can't say I'm enjoying it. I'm also annoyed that no one but Effie and I has shown up. Where's everybody else? I ask. Oh, who knows where Haymitch is, says Effie. I didn't really expect Haymitch, because he's probably just getting to bed. Sinner was up late working on organizing your garment car. He must have over 100 outfits for you. Your evening clothes are exquisite. And Peter's team is probably still asleep. Doesn't he need prepping? I ask. Not the way you do, Effie replies. What does this mean? It means I get to spend the morning having my hair ripped off my body while Peter sleeps in. I hadn't thought about it much, but in the arena at least some of the boys got to keep their body hair, whereas none of the girls did. I can remember Peter's now as I bathed him by the stream. Very blonde in the sunlight, once the mud and blood had been washed away. Only his face remained completely smooth. Not one of the boys grew a beard, and many were old enough to. I wonder what they did to them. If I feel ragged, my prep team seems in worse condition, knocking back coffee and sharing brightly colored little pills. As far as I can tell, they never get up before noon unless there's some sort of national emergency, like my leg hair. I was so happy when it grew back in, too, as if it were a sign that things might be returning to normal. I run my fingers along the soft, curly down on my legs and give myself over to the team. None of them are up to their usual chatter, so I can hear every strand being yanked from its follicle.
I have to soak in a tub full of a thick, unpleasant-smelling solution, while my face and hair are plastered with creams. Two more baths follow in other, less offensive concoctions. I'm plucked and scoured and massaged and anointed until I'm raw. Flavius tilts up my chin and sighs.
It's a shame Cinna said no alterations on you.
Yes, we could really make you something special, says Octavia.
When she's older, says Venia, almost grimly. Then he'll have to let us.
Do what? Blow my lips up like President Snow's? Tattoo my breasts? Dye my skin magenta and implant gems in it? Cut decorative patterns in my face? Give me curved talons or cat's whiskers? I saw all these things and more on the people in the capital. Do they really have no idea how freakish they look to the rest of us? The thought of being left to my prep team's fashion whims only adds to the miseries competing for my attention. My abused body, my lack of sleep, my mandatory marriage, and the terror of being unable to satisfy President Snow's demands. By the time I reach lunch, where Effie, Cinna, Portia, Haymitch, and Peeta have started without me, I'm too weighed down to talk. They're raving about the food and how well they sleep on trains. Everyone's all full of excitement about the tour. Well, everyone but Haymitch. He's nursing a hangover and picking at a muffin. I'm not really hungry either, maybe because I loaded up on too much rich stuff this morning, or maybe because I'm so unhappy. I play around with a bowl of broth, eating only a spoonful or two. I can't even look at Peeta, my designated future husband, although I know none of this is his fault. People notice, try to bring me into the conversation, but I just brush them off. At some point, the train stops. Our server reports it will not just be for a fuel stop. Some part has malfunctioned and must be replaced. It will require at least an hour. This sends Effie into a state. She pulls out her schedule and begins to work out how the delay will impact every event for the rest of our lives. Finally, I just can't stand to listen to her anymore.
No one cares, Effie, I snap.
Everyone at the table stares at me, even Haymitch, who you'd think would be on my side in this matter since Effie drives him nuts. I'm immediately put on the defensive.
Well, no one does,
I say, and get up and leave the dining car. The train suddenly seems stifling, and I'm definitely queasy now. I find the exit door, force it open, triggering some sort of alarm, which I ignore, and jump to the ground, expecting to land in snow. But the air's warm and balmy against my skin. The trees still wear green leaves. How far south have we come in a day? I walk along the track, squinting against the bright sunlight, already regretting my words to Effie. She's hardly to blame for my current predicament. I should go back and apologize. My outburst was the height of bad manners, and manners matter deeply to her. But my feet continue on along the track, past the end of the train, leaving it behind. An hour's delay. I can walk at least 20 minutes in one direction and make it back with plenty of time to spare. Instead, after a couple hundred yards, I sink to the ground and sit there, looking into the distance. If I had a bow and arrows, would I just keep going? After a while, I hear footsteps behind me. It'll be Haymitch, coming to chew me out. It's not like I don't deserve it, but I still don't want to hear it. I'm not in a mood for a lecture. I warn the clump of weeds by my shoes. I'll try to keep it brief. Peeta takes a seat beside me. I thought you were Haymitch, I say.
No, he's still working on that muffin.
I watch as Peeta positions his artificial leg.
Bad day, huh?
It's nothing, I say. He takes a deep breath.
Look, Katniss,
I've been wanting to talk to you about the way I acted on the train. I mean, the last train.
the one that brought us home. I knew you had something with Gale. I was jealous of him before I even officially met you. And it wasn't fair to hold you to anything that happened in the games. I'm sorry. His apology takes me by surprise. It's true that Peter froze me out after I confessed that my love for him during the games was something of an act. But I don't hold that against him. In the arena, I'd played that romance angle for all it was worth. There had been times when I didn't honestly know how I felt about him. I still don't, really. I'm sorry, too, I say. I'm not sure for what exactly. Maybe because there's a real chance I'm about to destroy him.
There's nothing for you to be sorry about. You were just keeping us alive. But I don't want us to go on like this, ignoring each other in real life and falling into the snow every time there's a camera around. So I thought if I stopped being so, you know, wounded, we could take a shot at just being friends, he says. All my friends are probably going to end up dead, but refusing Peter wouldn't keep him safe.
Okay, I say. His offer does make me feel better, less duplicitous somehow. It would be nice if he'd come to me with this earlier, before I knew that President Snow had other plans, and just being friends was not an option for us anymore. But either way, I'm glad we're speaking again.
So what's wrong? He asks.
I can't tell him. I pick at the clump of weeds.
Let's start with something more basic. Isn't it strange that I know you'd risk your life to save mine?
But I don't know what your favorite color is, he says. A smile creeps onto my lips. Green. What's yours?
Orange, he says.
Orange? Like Effie's hair, I say.
A bit more muted, he says. More like sunset.
Sunset. I can see it immediately, the rim of the descending sun, the sky streaked with soft shades of orange. Beautiful. I remember the tiger lily cookie, and now that Peter is talking to me again, it's all I can do not to recount the whole story about President Snow.
But I know Haymitch wouldn't want me to.
I'd better stick to small talk. You know, everyone's always raving about your paintings. I feel bad I haven't seen them, I say.
Well, I've got a whole train car full.
He rises and offers me his hand.
Come on.
It's good to feel his fingers entwined with mine again. Not for show, but in actual friendship. We walk back to the train hand in hand. At the door, I remember, I've got to apologize to Effie first.
Don't be afraid to lay it on thick, Peter tells me.
So when we go back to the dining car where the others are still at lunch, I give Effie an apology that I think is overkill, but in her mind probably just manages to compensate for my breach of etiquette. To her credit, Effie accepts graciously. She says it's clear I'm under a lot of pressure. And her comments about the necessity of someone attending to the schedule only last about 5 minutes. Really, I've gotten off easily. When Effie finishes, Peter leads me down a few cars to see his paintings. I don't know what I expected. Larger versions of the flower cookies, maybe. But this is something entirely different. Peter has painted the games. Some you wouldn't get right away if you hadn't been with him in the arena yourself. Water dripping through the cracks in our cave. The dry pond bed. A pair of hands, his own, digging for roots. Others any viewer would recognize. The golden horn called the cornucopia. Clove arranging the knives inside her jacket. One of the mutts, unmistakably the blonde, green-eyed one, meant to be Glimmer, snarling as it makes its way toward us. And me, I am everywhere, high up in a tree, beating a shirt against the stones in the stream, lying unconscious in a pool of blood,
and one I can't place. Perhaps this is how I looked when his fever was high, emerging from a silver-gray mist that matches my eyes exactly.
"What do you think?" he asks.
"I hate them," I say. I can almost smell the blood, the dirt, the unnatural breath of the mutt. All I do is go around trying to forget the arena, and you've brought it back to life. How do you remember these things so exactly?
I see them every night, he says.
I know what he means. Nightmares, which I was no stranger to before the games, now plague me whenever I sleep. But the old standby, the one of my father being blown to bits in the mines, is rare. Instead, I relive versions of what happened in the arena. My worthless attempt to save Rue. Peeta bleeding to death. Glimmer's bloated body disintegrating in my hands. Kato's horrific end with the mutations. These are the most frequent visitors. Me too. Does it help? To paint them out?
I don't know. I think I'm a little less afraid of going to sleep at night. Or I tell myself I am, he says. But they haven't gone anywhere.
Maybe they won't. Haymitch's haven't.
Haymitch doesn't say so, but I'm sure this is why he doesn't like to sleep in the dark. No. But for me, it's better to wake up with a paintbrush than a knife in my hand, he says. So you really hate them?
Yes, but they're extraordinary. Really, I say. And they are. But I don't want to look at them anymore. Want to see my talent? Cinna did a great job on it.
Peeta laughs. Later.
The train lurches forward, and I can see the land moving past us through the window.
Come on. We're almost to District 11. Let's go take a look at it.
We go down to the last car on the train. There are chairs and couches to sit on, but what's wonderful is that the back windows retract into the ceiling, so you're riding outside in the fresh air, and you can see a wide sweep of the landscape. Huge open fields with herds of dairy cattle grazing in them. So unlike our own heavily wooded home. We slow slightly, and I think we might be coming in for another stop when a fence rises up before us. Towering at least 35 feet in the air and topped with wicked coils of barbed wire, it makes ours back in District 12 look childish. My eyes quickly inspect the base, which is lined with enormous metal plates. There would be no burrowing under those, no escaping to hunt. Then I see the watchtowers, placed evenly apart, manned with armed guards, so out of place among the fields of wildflowers around them.
That's something different, says Peeta.
Rue did give me the impression that the rules in District 11 were more harshly enforced. But I never imagined something like this. Now the crops begin, stretched out as far as the eye can see. Men, women, and children wearing straw hats to keep off the sun straighten up, turn our way, take a moment to stretch their backs as they watch our train go by. I can see orchards in the distance, and I wonder if that's where Rue would have worked, collecting the fruit from the slimmest branches at the tops of the trees. Small communities of shacks, by comparison the houses in the seam are upscale, spring up here and there, but they're all deserted. Every hand must be needed for the harvest. On and on it goes. I can't believe the size of District 11.
How many people do you think live here? Peeta asks.
I shake my head. In school they refer to it as a large district, that's all. No actual figures on the population. But those kids we see on camera waiting for the reaping each year, they can't be but a sampling of the ones who actually live here. What do they do? Have preliminary drawings? Pick the winners ahead of time and make sure they're in the crowd? How exactly did Rue end up on that stage?
with nothing but the wind offering to take her place. I begin to weary of the vastness, the endlessness of this place. When Effie comes to tell us to dress, I don't object. I go to my compartment and let the prep team do my hair and makeup. Cinna comes in with a pretty orange frock patterned with autumn leaves. I think how much Peeta will like the color. Effie gets Peeta and me together and goes through the day's program one last time. In some districts, the victors ride through the city while the residents cheer. But in 11, maybe because there's not much of a city to begin with, things being so spread out, or maybe because they don't want to waste so many people while the harvest is on, the public appearance is confined to the square. It takes place before their justice building, a huge marble structure. Once it must have been a thing of beauty, but time has taken its toll. Even on television you can see ivy overtaking the crumbling facade, the sag of the roof. The square itself is ringed with run-down storefronts, most of which are abandoned. Wherever the well-to-do live in District 11, it's not here. Our entire public performance will be staged outside on what Effie refers to as the veranda, the tiled expanse between the front doors and the stairs that's shaded by a roof supported by columns. Peeta and I will be introduced. The mayor of 11 will read a speech in our honor and will respond with a scripted thank you provided by the Capitol. If a victor had any special allies among the dead tributes, it is considered good form to add a few personal comments as well. I should say something about Rue and Thresh, too, really, but every time I tried to write it at home, I ended up with a blank paper staring me in the face. It's hard for me to talk about them without getting emotional. Fortunately, Peeta has a little something worked up, and with some slight alterations it can count for both of us. At the end of the ceremony, we'll be presented with some sort of plaque, and then we can withdraw to the Justice Building, where a special dinner will be served. As the train is pulling into the District 11 station, Cinna puts the finishing touches on my outfit, switching my orange hairband for one of metallic gold, and securing the Mockingjay pin I wore in the arena to my dress. There's no welcoming committee on the platform, just a squad of 8 peacekeepers who direct us into the back of an armored truck. Effie sniffs as the door clanks closed behind us.
"Really? You'd think we were all criminals," she says.
"Not all of us, Effie. Just me, I think."
The truck lets us out at the back of the Justice Building. We're hurried inside. I can smell an excellent meal being prepared, but it doesn't block out the odors of mildew and rot. They've left us no time to look around. As we make a beeline for the front entrance, I can hear the anthem beginning outside in the square. Someone clips a microphone on me. Peeta takes my left hand. The mayor's introducing us as the massive doors open with a groan.
"Big smiles," Effie says, and gives us a nudge.
Our feet start moving forward. This is it. This is where I have to convince everybody how in love I am with Peeta, I think. The solemn ceremony is pretty tightly mapped out, so I'm not sure how to do it. It's not a time for kissing, but maybe I can work one in. There's loud applause, but none of the other responses we got in the Capitol, the cheers and whoops and whistles. We walk across the shaded veranda until the roof runs out, and we're standing at the top of a big flight of marble stairs in the glaring sun. As my eyes adjust, I see the buildings on the square have been hung with banners that help cover up their neglected state. It's packed with people, but again, just a fraction of the number who live here. As usual, a special platform has been constructed at the bottom of the stage for the families of the dead tributes. On Thresh's side, there's only an old woman with a hunched back and a tall, muscular girl, I'm guessing is his sister. On Rue's, I'm not prepared for Rue's family. Her parents, whose faces are still fresh with sorrow. her 5 younger siblings, who resemble her so closely. The slight builds, the luminous brown eyes, they form a flock of small, dark birds. The applause dies out, and the mayor gives the speech in our honor. 2 little girls come up with tremendous bouquets of flowers. Peter does his part of the scripted reply, and then I find my lips moving to conclude it. Fortunately, my mother and Prim have drilled me, so I can do it in my sleep. Peter had his personal comments written on a card, but he doesn't pull it out. Instead, he speaks in his simple winning style about Thresh and Rue making it to the final 8, about how they both kept me alive, thereby keeping him alive, and about how this is a debt we can never repay. And then he hesitates before adding something that wasn't written on the card, maybe because he thought Effie might make him remove it. "It can in no way replace your losses, but as a token of our thanks, we'd like for each of the tribute's families from District 11 to receive 1 month of our winnings every year for the duration of our lives." The crowd can't help but respond with gasps and murmurs. There is no precedent for what Peter has done. I don't even know if it's legal. He probably doesn't know either, so he didn't ask in case it isn't. As for the families, they just stare at us in shock. Their lives were changed forever when Thresh and Rue were lost, but this gift will change them again. A month of tribute winnings can easily provide for a family for a year. As long as we live, they will not hunger. I look at Peter, and he gives me a sad smile. I hear Hamish's voice.
"You could do a lot worse."
At this moment, it's impossible to imagine how I could do any better. The gift, it is perfect. So when I rise up on tiptoe to kiss him, it doesn't seem forced at all. The mayor steps forward and presents us each with a plaque that's so large I have to put down my bouquet to hold it. The ceremony's about to end when I notice one of Rue's sisters staring at me. She must be about 9 and is almost an exact replica of Rue, down to the way she stands with her arms slightly extended. Despite the good news about the winnings, she's not happy. In fact, her look is reproachful. Is it because I didn't save Rue? No. It's because I still haven't thanked her, I think. A wave of shame rushes through me. The girl is right. How can I stand here, passive and mute, leaving all the words to Peter? If she had won, Rue would never have let my death go unsung. I remember how I took care in the arena to cover her with flowers, to make sure her loss did not go unnoticed, but that gesture will mean nothing if I don't support it now. Wait! I stumble forward, pressing the plaque to my chest. My allotted time for speaking has come and gone, but I must say something. I owe too much. And even if I had pledged all my winnings to the families, it would not excuse my silence today. Wait, please. I don't know how to start, but once I do, the words rush from my lips as if they've been forming in the back of my mind for a long time. I want to give my thanks to the tributes of District 11, I say. I look at the pair of women on Thresh's side. I only ever spoke to Thresh 1 time, just long enough for him to spare my life. I didn't know him, but I always respected him for his power, for his refusal to play the games on anyone's terms but his own. The careers wanted him to team up with them from the beginning, but he wouldn't do it. I respected him for that. For the first time, the old hunched woman, is she Thresh's grandmother? Raises her head, and the trace of a smile plays on her lips. The crowd has fallen silent now, so silent that I wonder how they manage it. They must all be holding their breath.
I turned to Rue's family, but I feel as if I did know Rue, and she'll always be with me. Everything beautiful brings her to mind. I see her in the yellow flowers that grow in the meadow by my house. I see her in the mockingjays that sing in the trees. But most of all, I see her in my sister, Prim.
My voice is undependable, but I am almost finished.
Thank you for your children.
I raise my chin to address the crowd.
And thank you all for the bread.
I stand there, feeling broken and small, thousands of eyes trained on me. There's a long pause. Then, from somewhere in the crowd, someone whistles Rue's four-note mockingjay tune, the one that signaled the end of the workday in the orchards, the one that meant safety in the arena. By the end of the tune, I have found the whistler, a wizened old man in a faded red shirt and overalls. His eyes meet mine. What happens next is not an accident. It is too well executed to be spontaneous, because it happens in complete unison. Every person in the crowd presses the three middle fingers of their left hand against their lips and extends them to me. It's our sign from District 12, the last goodbye I gave Rue in the arena. If I hadn't spoken to President Snow, this gesture might move me to tears. But with his recent orders to calm the districts fresh in my ears, it fills me with dread. What will he think of this very public salute to the girl who defied the Capitol? The full impact of what I've done hits me. It was not intentional. I only meant to express my thanks, but I have elicited something dangerous. An act of dissent from the people of District 11. This is exactly the kind of thing I am supposed to be diffusing. I try to think of something to say to undermine what has just happened, to negate it, but I can hear the slight burst of static indicating my microphone has been cut off and the mayor has taken over. Peter and I acknowledge a final round of applause. He leads me back toward the doors, unaware that anything has gone wrong. I feel funny and have to stop for a moment. Little bits of bright sunshine dance before my eyes.
"Are you all right?"
Peter asks.
"Just dizzy. The sun was so bright,"
I say. I see his bouquet.
"I forgot my flowers,"
I mumble. "I'll get them," he says.
"I can,"
I answer. We would be safe inside the Justice Building by now if I hadn't stopped, if I hadn't left my flowers. Instead, from the deep shade of the veranda, we see the whole thing. A pair of peacekeepers dragging the old man who whistled to the top of the steps, forcing him to his knees before the crowd, and putting a bullet through his head.
Chapter 5.
The man has only just crumpled to the ground when a wall of white peacekeeper uniforms blocks our view. Several of the soldiers have automatic weapons held lengthwise as they push us back toward the door.
"We're going," says Peter, shoving the peacekeeper who's pressing on me.
"We get it, all right? Come on, Katniss." His arm encircles me and guides me back into the Justice Building. The peacekeepers follow a pace or two behind us. The moment we're inside, the doors slam shut, and we hear the peacekeepers' boots moving back toward the crowd. Hamish, Effie, Portia, and Cinna wait under a static-filled screen that's mounted on the wall, their faces tight with anxiety.
"What happened?"
Effie hurries over.
"We lost the feed just after Katniss's beautiful speech, and then Hamish said he thought he heard a gunfire, and I said it was ridiculous, but who knows? There are lunatics everywhere."
"Nothing happened, Effie. An old truck backfired," says Peter evenly. Two more shots.
The door doesn't muffle their sound much. Who was that?
Thresh's grandmother? One of Rue's little sisters?
Both of you, with me, says Haymitch.
Peeta and I follow him, leaving the others behind. The peacekeepers who are stationed around the justice building take little interest in our movements now that we are safely inside. We ascend a magnificent curved marble staircase. At the top, there's a long hall with worn carpet on the floor. Double doors stand open, welcoming us into the first room we encounter. The ceiling must be 20 feet high. Designs of fruit and flowers are carved into the molding, and small, fat children with wings look down at us from every angle. Vases of blossoms give off a cloying scent that makes my eyes itch. Our evening clothes hang on racks against the wall. This room has been prepared for our use, but we're barely there long enough to drop off our gifts. Then Haymitch yanks the microphones from our chests, stuffs them beneath a couch cushion, and waves us on. As far as I know, Haymitch has only been here once, when he was on his victory tour decades ago. But he must have a remarkable memory or reliable instincts, because he leads us up through a maze of twisting staircases and increasingly narrow halls. At times he has to stop and force a door. By the protesting squeak of the hinges, you can tell it's been a long time since it was opened. Eventually we climb a ladder to a trap door. When Haymitch pushes it aside, we find ourselves in the dome of the justice building. It's a huge place filled with broken furniture, piles of books and ledgers, and rusty weapons. The coat of dust blanketing everything is so thick it's clear it hasn't been disturbed for years. Light struggles to filter in through four grimy square windows set in the sides of the dome. Haymitch kicks the trapdoor shut and turns on us.
"What happened?" he asks.
Peeta relates all that occurred in the square. The whistle, the salute, our hesitation on the veranda, the murder of the old man.
"What's going on, Haymitch?"
"It'll be better coming from you," Haymitch says to me.
I don't agree. I think it will be 100 times worse coming from me. But I tell Peeta everything as calmly as I can. About President Snow, the unrest in the districts. I don't even omit the kiss with Gail. I lay out how we are all in jeopardy, how the whole country is in jeopardy because of my trick with the berries. I was supposed to fix things on this tour, make everyone who had doubted believe I acted out of love, calm things down. But obviously, all I've done today is get 3 people killed, and now everyone in the square will be punished. I feel so sick that I have to sit down on a couch, despite the exposed springs and stuffing.
Then I made things worse, too, by giving them money, says Peeta.
Suddenly he strikes out at a lamp that sits precariously on a crate and knocks it across the room, where it shatters against the floor.
This has to stop, right now. This game you two play, where you tell each other secrets but keep them from me like I'm too inconsequential or stupid or weak to handle them.
It's not like that, Peeta, I begin.
It's exactly like that, he yells at me. I have people I care about too, Katniss, family and friends back in District 12 who will be just as dead as yours if we don't pull this thing off. So after all we went through in the arena, don't I even rate the truth from you?
You're always so reliably good, Peeta, says Haymitch. So smart about how you present yourself before the cameras. I didn't want to disrupt that.
Well, you overestimated me, because I really screwed up today. What do you think is going to happen to Rue's and Thresh's families? Do you think they'll get their share of our winnings? Do you think I gave them a bright future? Because I think they'll be lucky if they survive the day.
Peeta sends something else flying, a statue. I've never seen him like this. He's right, Haymitch, I say. We were wrong not to tell him, even back in the capital.
Even in the arena, you two had some sort of system worked out, didn't you?
asks Peeta. His voice is quieter now. Something I wasn't part of.
No, not officially. I just could tell what Haymitch wanted me to do by what he sent or didn't send, I say.
Well, I never had that opportunity.